Wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
We're down in the new basement studios by the lake, one of our summertime shows where we're going to weave through a couple of subjects. Okay.
Yeah.
But as always, in engaging with our listeners, we need to start with some mailbag news.
Right.
On the last show, we gave a shout out to one of our fans, Liz the Librarian. Remember, we were having our discussion about...
Is it Liz the Librarian or Librarian yeah. Liz? I can't remember.
It can be either. I mean, I'll let these fans select their own sort of monikers. Yeah. And we were having a discussion. We mentioned her in a discussion about streaming TV and whatever. Anyway, she mailed back to say, thank you for the shout out. Her and her sister listened to the show. But in her correspondence, the big thing
What's her sister's name? Is her sister also a librarian? Or
I don't know. I don't know if it's like a family business.
I hope she has an alliterative nickname as well.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Claire, no. Alison the accountant?
Exactly, yeah. Something like that.
Yeah. Claire the CPA? Claire the clinician?
Alison Roloff office. Yeah, that's better. Yeah. That's better. It's got a
Dolores
punctuation
doctor.
To it.
Yeah. Anyway, Liz the librarian and her sister both said, we would very much listen to a St. Elmo's commentary.
Uh-huh.
So I know what I'm saying.
Does that mean they own the disc by any chance? Because one of the things we'll need is a standardized disc, DVD of the movie so that, in other words, standardized and so that everybody who would put it into their thing to listen to or watch the movie, our commentary would be synced up. Like, we don't want any director's cuts or anything like that.
Is there a director's cut of St. Elmo's Fire?
I assume not. But, you know, nothing with any added bits that would, like, change the sequencing of the item. Because I kind of figured when we started that out, we would be, oh, this is the credit. We'd be telling people what's going on screen so they could synchronize to it.
Yeah. We'll have to do some research to see if there
is. Anyway, simply, I don't have a disc of it.
And, so basically, what you're now saying is what we want to engage in with our fans. We also want our fans to actually send us the stuff.
Yeah, well, my guess is actually, I haven't checked. I'll check on Amazon. Maybe, you know, that could be a DVD that's maybe like $8. So maybe we'll just buy it.
Well, you can buy it secondhand.
I tell you what, the other member of the household who is not going to be happy about us disparaging of St. Elmo's Fire, well, not that we necessarily would. I mean, we may have many
compliments for it.
I'm sure she wouldn't mind having a copy of it around the house.
Okay. So if you're out there and you feel like you want to just give us a present, we are actually, our wish list this year involves a DVD copy of St. Elmo's Fire.
Yep.
And because I've become a bit of a Blu-ray snob as I've got older.
Right.
If you have the Blu-ray, that would be preferred.
We'll take that.
Yeah.
We want a high-definition version of...
High definition. If I'm going to sit through that
Sheedy.
Film...
Is Ali Sheedy in that? I don't even remember now.
It's Demi Moore, Ali Sheedy... And Mare Willingham. They're the three female leads.
Right.
They're the Fierettes, I think is actually the
Judd term. Nelson, Emilio Estevez.
And Rob Lowe. And I always think...
Andrew McCarthy.
Yeah, because there's seven of them. There's the spare.
Right. they're out of alignment.
Yeah, out of alignment. So anyway, that's a bit of... Did you have any listener feedback from anyone? Anyone you wanted to shout out?
No, I got an indirect comment from somebody on my question as to why people don't fish for birds, which doesn't really make a lot of sense in itself, but you'd have to go back to check it out.
Yeah, I can't remember when we did that story. I think maybe this time last year when we were just doing a story about summer. I think the show is called Summertime, and we were just sort of talking about summertime pursuits.
Yeah, I think we were talking about fishing, and I just sort of commented, hey, you know, why didn't anybody invent a way of, like, catching birds that was, like, throwing a line out that you would catch a bird? It was evidence of somebody exploring the back catalog. So if you're new to the podcast, realize that all these things, we're approaching 3 years at this point. I don't know what the number of actual podcasts are, but roughly, you know, average basically every other week. So there's
about 100 hours.
Yeah, at least
100 hours. You could spend days just with us in, you know, orally accompanying
a big like cross country road trip with us on the radio.
Yeah.
You eventually rip it out and throw it out on the street.
You might do, but I can guarantee you'll also learn a lot of things.
Yeah.
So anyway, there you go. There's some listener feedback. Fishing for birds. What was their comment about fishing for birds?
No, it wasn't anything particular. I think they were making an observation that made it clear they had listened in. And
I will say this.
Interesting.
Because when you mentioned it to me, I did think back a little bit. I actually think that is a lot of people. I know there are some people who laugh at your idea. I actually think it's quite a good one. But I now know why they haven't done it.
Which is?
Well, a fish has like a soft mouth.
Right.
And so when it bites the hook goes into its mouth. Birds' beaks are harder.
Yeah.
So it's designing the hook.
No, it would be bad. You couldn't really use a regular hook. Plus, like when a fish, you catch a fish, you could hold a fish because it's out of water and you can take the hook out. I can't imagine if you reeled in a bird, how you would take a bird off of your line without injuring yourself. It's got talons and all kinds of things going on. But maybe something that just sort of...
Well, I remember the first time I ever caught a fish,
A net. You know, kind of brought them in. I keep looking over your shoulder because there's a bunch of birds flying around on the just outside of our window later, here. Yeah.
Well, I remember the first time I ever caught a fish when I was a kid. I was in a rowing boat, and I can't remember how old I was, 10 or 11. And it was me and a buddy of mine. And we got the fish into the rowing boat. And it was flopping around. And at that age, we didn't quite know what to do.
Yeah, nobody wants it. The first time around, nobody really wants to touch the fish. It's too scary. Yeah.
So I remember taking the plastic baler and just beating the fish to death. And I do remember. And so what I'm saying is, I'm sure that if the first time you and I fished for birds, you know, even we probably wouldn't have thought ahead to what we were going to do when we reeled it in. I'm sure we could grab a nearby implement and beat the bird to death.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to do that. And I think
why not?
I think we're beyond the stage that you were when you were 11 years old in fishing. I think we realize how to handle animals better at this point in our life. I hope.
But why is it? There seems to be this double standard now between fish and we have to.
No, treat but most the birds times people properly. Catch fish. I mean, other than you're going to eat it, you throw it back. And even if you were going to eat
I always eat it.
No, if I catch, you don't always eat it.
Let me correct. If I catch a fish of a day, when I go fishing,
right,
my intent is obviously the adrenaline rush of hooking a fish and imagining that I'm like on Jaws and fighting with the fish and bringing it in. But ultimately, in the back of my mind somewhere, if the fish is, you know, 10 inches or more, well, I am planning to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't go, you know, if I caught a big fish, I'll go, maybe I should take that home and eat it.
Well, there's some fish that aren't good enough to merit eating. Even bigger fish, they might leave throw it. But in any event, in any event, if you're going to eat it, I imagine you would not beat it to death with a baler now. If nothing else, you're going to break up the bones. You're not going to have a good piece of fish anymore. True, yeah. So, like, there's a way that you
I just leave it on a rock off and let it suffocate.
That's not good either.
Because then I'm feel like I'm not interfering.
You really want to put it in a situation where it won't be rotten by the time you get back. So just leaving it on a rock isn't ideal. So maybe...
I'm not going to leave it on a rock for days. I'm going to leave it on a rock for, like, 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And then it's just going to die.
And then what are you going to do with it?
Well, then it's dead. Then I'll put it in a...
You got to put it in your creel. I always love that word.
What?
Creel is the little basket that
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it is. I hope I haven't gotten that one wrong. But
I put it in a cooler, take it home, out my fish knife, scale it, chop off the head, chop off the tail, gut it, bang, in the oven.
You remember A River Runs Through It?
Yes.
Yeah, so they have that little basket where they put the fish in. I think that's a creel. Okay. I think that's what it's called.
Oh, okay.
If I'm wrong, I've just said it 8 times and somebody will tell me I'm certain after this.
It does sound sort of... Creole.
It does sound
fishy. It feels like you should be fishing or shrimping or something with a creel.
We talked about angling. Never mind. We're not going to talk about it. We talk enough about fish.
Fishing is a different show.
A bunch of fishing words that are interesting origins.
We can actually go and fish and just have it on a show and talk fishing. Yep. And even see if we can snag the occasional bird. Mm-hmm. All right, let's get on with this.
Speaking of movies, right?
Yes. That was a good segue.
I'm handing it to you. It's your story about the trailers.
Trailers. Okay. Then. Mm-hmm. I sent my partner a story this week from The Guardian, but anyone who has followed any entertainment website, the director of Jurassic World, Colin, is it Trevorrow, had been quite critical.
Yep.
When the Jurassic World trailers came out earlier this year, apparently Josh Whedon, a director, was critical of one of them and said it was very sexist in the way that it portrayed the
Chris
female
Pratt
lead.
And Bryce Dallas Howard's interaction was...
The characters were very stereotypical. Then earlier this week, the director had come out and he hadn't disagreed with Joss Whedon's point.
No, in fact, he sort of said the same.
He said the same thing.
I agree. I didn't get to pick, though, what they used. And in fact, the movie, he thought, progressed past that. So this was a little cliched moment.
Yeah. He also felt that the trailers also gave away, in his mind, one of the plot twists.
Right.
Which was the fact that Chris Pratt's character was a Velociraptor trainer. So, there were a couple of articles online with directors really criticizing the people that do the trailers, because apparently it's handled by the studio. A director doesn't really have any input as to what's in the trailer. Also this week, Alan Taylor.
That wasn't the biggest twist in the world, but this other.
Well, I was going to lay out the story and then we come back. Alan Taylor, the director of the new Terminator film, Terminator Genesis, he came out and criticized his film's trailer, but I wasn't quite sure what his criticism was.
Well, it gave away a major plot point, which I was telling this story to somebody last night and talking about this, and they're like, wait, don't tell me what it is. And I'm like, well, but it's given away in the trailer. And he's like, I don't see enough TV to see the trailers. I want to actually see the movie. So there's a twist that's sort of central to the story.
Yes.
In the Terminator spoiler. Genesis.
Yes, spoiler.
And they give it away in the trailer. And so that director had said, well, listen, I know the marketing people, I think, thought people are going to look at this trailer and be like, whatever, it's another Terminator movie. That's and like correct. By introducing this twist, I think the marketing people thought, well, this will show people there's something new here. It's some value in coming and seeing this, because it's just not, it's not the same old thing. Ooh, you know, robots chasing people around kind of thing. So it does give it away. I don't want to give it away here. Although, the other part is this movie's been a huge bomb since it came out. So it don't really matter too much. The marketing people clearly realized they were going to have a hard time selling this movie. And so maybe they were justified in giving away this twist.
Now,
between those two, right? The guy complaining about the Jurassic Park, which is turning out to be one of the biggest movies of all time, versus which actually we should come back to that in a moment here, versus the guy talking about Terminator Genesis, they have a much greater standing in their landing their critiques about the movies because of the way the movies are doing.
Obviously, I thought this was very interesting because longtime listeners of the show will know one of our signature episodes is our annual summer movie previews.
That's right. Which, even though we're halfway through the summer, it's a two-parter, so you can always catch the second half.
There's a whole lot of films still to come that you can go back and listen to at least part two. Anyway, I felt that this story is relevant to us because that's how we review these people's films is via their trailers. So
clearly so does Joss Whedon. I didn't realize when Joss Whedon launched his original attack for this thing being sexist, I thought he'd seen the movie. And then I realized, no, it's based on like a 30-second trailer. He's like, oh, that was a very sexist trailer. And maybe he could dial it back a little bit on the bashing people on the tweets there.
I did feel a little bit, I guess my overriding sense was Hollywood needs to get its act together for their own benefit. The trailers need to make sense. The trailers need to represent the product.
Right.
Because if nothing else, that's how we are evaluating
it. Exactly. Yeah, listen, so, if that trailer's not good enough, they're not going to get a stamp of approval from us. So they need to keep that in mind. What is the Atlantic Voice going to say about this?
I did find it interesting, though, that it does say something. We always, with our tongue in our cheek, when we do our movie review, we always make a joke of the fact that we are just reviewing the trailers. But ultimately, nowadays, that is your 2 minutes to sell your product.
Sure.
It is no different than a beer commercial on TV or a commercial for house paint or toilet paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it interesting that, A, the directors didn't have anything really to do with it. But I also found it interesting in the case of these two movies. The one guy was the guy from Jurassic World was complaining about his trailer, and yet in a strange way, I'm not suggesting that the criticisms that the trailers were sexist or they gave away plot points. I'm not suggesting those criticisms are not valid, but for that film, what does it matter?
Right.
Even Joss Whedon's original point, and I'm not saying that the characters. And I've seen Jurassic World. I'm not saying the characters are or are not sort of stereotypically represented as whatever. But at the end of the day, well, that's the movie you've made anyway. And what I mean by that is I'm not going to Jurassic World going, oh, I hope the film is rich in characterization. No, I'm going to Jurassic World.
Or plot twists.
I'm going to Jurassic World because I want to see some dinosaurs run amok. And the one thing the trailer accurately did do was show dinosaurs are running amok.
Right.
So in a strange way, I understand people are upset about the trailer, but the trailer is accurate.
Yeah.
I do remember, and the reason that I sent you the story this week when the Terminator director was criticizing the trailer, if you listen to part two, I think we reviewed Terminator in part two of this year's summer movie preview. We both said, I know I said, the trailer makes absolutely no sense to me at all. I had no idea what was going on. So I can't decide if his criticism is accurate, because the waters are... I think
the things that were confusing about it were part of the plot twist. And obviously, I mean, it must get somewhat straight. Although a bunch of the reviews by the professional reviewers who saw the whole movie were basically, this thing's really confusing too. like they were just saying, listen, they spent, I think one of the reviews talked about how the character spent a ton of time explaining what was going on. Yes. Like it was all this like, oh, and we're in this time, this person came back because they realized nobody's going to be able to follow this circles of time travel.
So basically I find it interesting that directors are now putting the boot into their own trailers for their films.
Yeah.
I do think that one director, dude, don't worry about it. Your movie has made billions. Right. And the other guy...
Well, the other guy might be covering himself a little bit. Like, that's why, you know, had a bomb. He's like, you know, the real problem is here. They gave away the yes. thing, and so nobody came to see it. Yeah. I don't think that works, but I'm sure that's the attempt there.
That being said, and I know we will cover this ground again in November when we do our summer movie roundup. It's interesting how our review of the trailer has been accurately reflected in the professional critics review.
Shows how right we are.
Which shows how right we are.
And listen, you know, early returns in, we predicted Jurassic Park would be the biggest movie.
Both said that,
and it certainly seems like it's going to be. I mean, I guess the Marvel...
Avengers,
it's coming out, maybe has a shot at it, but I doubt it's going to hit it. The one, and this is something I was thinking about saving for the end of the summer, but I think it's appropriate
to talk about it.
So it is... I think we underestimated the significance of the Lost World Jurassic Park movie as a killer movie for this summer. And I think that's because we're a little bit too old for the first movies to have had the same impression. Like, we saw the first movies as 20-something-year-olds, maybe 30.
Yeah, nothing exactly.
So that was a really cool movie kind of
thing. We weren't teenagers, though.
Right. Well, that's we went to see Mad Max, myself and the other member of the household went to see Mad Max, and we're at a restaurant beforehand, and can we get the check? No dessert. We're going to go off to, what movie are you going to see? Mad Max. And he said, this guy who was clearly like 32 maybe, or, you know, give or take 30, or, you know, was... Oh, I'm so excited to see Lost World, or maybe he'd already seen it and he was going to see it again kind of thing. And the way he was talking about it reminded me the way I talk about Star Wars movies. You know, like, I think there's a lot of folks who were basically teenagers when they saw the first ones, and this wasn't just like a really cool movie. This was a mind-blowing movie,
yes.
You know, with dinosaurs on screen. Yeah. And so when this new one came out, it doesn't really even matter what it was about, which is kind of what we said anyway.
Yes.
It was their home. It was like their like formative experience in terms of seeing big movies, and so they're all running out to see it. And we're going to go see it too. But I think we underestimated the depth of its appeal to a certain segment of the populace that I never really thought about it as that type of movie.
No, and you're right. I mean, definitely
series.
For people, I would imagine, you know, like you say, 10 to 15 younger than us, and we are an indeterminate middle age. It does resonate in the same way that Star Wars, which I know we're going to talk about shortly, in the way that Star Wars resonates with us. And only when I now say that out loud in the way you've just said it, does my mind turn over and go, okay, yeah, I get it now for people how it's this sort of touchstone with their youth.
Right.
That for us, we go, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's a really cool movie. I'll go see some dinosaurs too, but it's not.
I don't feel the same way about it. And so, yeah, I'm surprised at how big. Because to be frank with you, without getting into it too deep, yeah, it's an okay movie. I wouldn't say it's great. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, yeah, you know, unless the dinosaur is involved in some sort of, I don't know, intrigue or whatever, it escapes and it eats people. You know, it's not like it escapes and decides to rob a bank. Do you know what I mean? At the end of the day, your dinosaur movie, it's relatively structured.
It's not a crime or spy movie around dinosaurs.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, so, well, anyway.
Perfect matchup. So Star Wars, we let ourselves right into Star Wars. The other new movie news of the week.
Big news this week.
The announcement of the Star Wars. So we've talked about this before. They're doing the new Star Wars movies. Three more Star Wars movies.
Those first three movies are crap. Those last three movies are great. Or the other way around, depending how you sequence them.
So these are the subsequent three, the later three trilogy to go with the other two trilogies. So again, it's a trilogy of trilogies. But they're also doing other like isolated pieces around the Star Wars. I mean, clearly what now that Disney owns Lucasfilm and it's all being turned into a Star Wars universe.
What was the phrase? Because I know we'll talk about it, but one of the producers, and we will talk about this, I think it was this time last week, Comic Con, the big comic book convention.
Well, yeah, now it's everything.
Whatever
it's,
it is.
It's yeah, all kinds I mean, it's of.
Beyond that. That one of the central moments was a panel appearance of Star Wars stars, J.J. Abrams, and what the producers. And one of the producers at this panel, hosted by Chris Hardwick, a fellow podcaster, I get to say that, Chris Hardwick.
The midnight show on Comedy Central.
And then isn't he the Nerdist?
Yes, I think so.
So, again, he is a fellow podcaster.
Was briefly rumored as a candidate for the Daily Show.
Would have been quite good, I think. I quite like him. But yep. Anyway, it was one of those open panels where he asked questions and, you know, all these guys are sitting at a long table behind the mic espousing on their product. Anyway, one of the producers talked about, and I wish I could remember the terminology she used. She said they now have two different sorts of films in development. They have anthology,
mm-hmm.
which I'm guessing...
That's got to be the main movies.
The main films. And then she had a word similar to anthology, but different, to refer to the individual movies. And it wasn't standalone,
mm-hmm.
but I wish I could remember what the phrase was. But even in-house now at Disney, there's clearly a corporate lingo for, okay, you're either working on the standard Star Wars, it's going to be this narrative trail through Death Star and Princess Leia and beyond, and then there is going to be other Star
Actually,
Wars
what's
films.
Interesting is maybe the anthology is the other way around. So
I think anthology is what Kathleen Kennedy is the producer. Well, anthology was the phrase she used to refer to the films that are in the Star Wars family and that they have some relation to the main narrative thrust,
right.
But it's not what you think of as...
So I've got up here the Star Wars website itself it's a Han Solo movie, right? Christopher Miller and Phil Lord to helm Han Solo anthology film.
That's the Lego
guys. So I think the anthology must mean the little ancillary. So they've already announced one for Boba Fett and one around something called Rogue Squadron, which would be like a rebel.
But that's the first one coming out, Rogue Squadron, right?
Yeah,
they're working on it now. I think that's the one Gareth Edwards, the director of Godzilla, that's the one he's working on.
Right. So they're announcing it's essentially a Han Solo prequel. So it's supposed to tell us how Han Solo became the swashbuckling smuggler that he was. You just said it's Christopher Miller and Phil Lord. They're the folks who did the 21 Jump Street and a Lego movie and also 22 Jump Street. They're directors of those. They've done some writing and directing, so I can't remember. They're not writing this.
Jump Street.
This one's being written by Lawrence Kent. Well, they did Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
That's right.
This one's being written by Lawrence Kasdan, who is the writer of Empire Strikes Back and like the second two of the original series and then the first one of this new series. So the Force Awakens, the one that's being created. And his son, I love this when people do this, his son, John Kasdan, is the co-writer on this Han Solo one. John Kasdan has some writing credits as well, but it's like TV, Freaks and Geeks, which is a long time ago, so I don't know what the heck he's been doing since then. Again, Kathleen Kennedy is the main person at Disney who's doing the production and all these movies.
I think she sort of sits there and sort of controls the whole Star Wars product. The two guys, the directors of Lego Movie and 21 Jump Street, their filmography is relatively short. They're mm-hmm. quite young. But in terms of sort of, you know, pounds per square inch type thing,
yeah,
they
haven't had any misses yet.
Every film they've done is big. And I find it interesting, too, because they are one of those directing teams that are actually still quite rare. There's the Coen brothers, but even when you hear the Coen brothers interviewed, one of them takes the lead with the directing and whatever. There's the famous Wachowski brothers. We all refer to them as... No, the sibling team, because one of them had a gender... flip over.
Reassignment.
So it is interesting, but you know, these guys, you know, they've done two primarily kids movies, I guess you could say, in Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and the Lego movie, although I never saw Cloudy, but I did see the Lego movie, and I was shocked at how much I enjoyed it.
Right. Well, that's why I think these guys seem like a really good candidate for a movie that's going to be about Han Solo. It's supposed to have some, you know, Han Solo, all his bits were, there was like a humor line to it, you know. So, like, even when they came out, they made some jokes when they were announced. Like, one of the jokes was, well, this will be the first project we've gotten involved with and where we didn't have a level of nervous. I have to get the right phrase, but basically the other ones, like the Lego movie, got presented to them, and there was a reasonable chance when they looked at it, they said, this could be a fiasco, right? You're like, and it all, and like,
well, I think we said that on 21
Jump Street, like, that, you know, there was a certain skepticism. This one, they feel like, hey, listen, we are clearly going to get given something good to work with, but they said at the same time, they plan to take some risks, do something, you know, they're going to make sure they preserve the ethos of it and be funny and all that sort of stuff. But the biggest question, well, go ahead. Well, we'll come to the biggest question in a second.
What you just said there, I remember when we previewed on one of our shows from 2013, we previewed when the Lego movie trailer came out. We watched the trailer, and I remember sitting here going, that movie is going to bomb. And it ended up being very entertaining. I watched it. I was nervous about the Jump Street.
Right.
The mini franchise. Yeah. I was like, oh, Jump Street? Seriously? What are they going to do with that? Again, these guys have been very successful with that. Me personally, while the notion of a Han Solo, I guess, origin story, because it's not a reboot.
Sort of, it's an origin story.
I'm like, oh, I'm a bit nervous about that too. So I guess if you're these two guys, you should feel good about it, because I've been consistently nervous about
your other podcast. Saying, oh, we got this great material, but honestly, if I was them, I mean,
I'd be nervous about
the reaction when this stuff came out. Was a lot of people were like, hold on a second, like, do we even want this? Because Han Solo is Han Solo. He's Harrison Ford. He's the person that we had there. You try to give me some other version with some other actor, which is the really big question, right? We'll talk about that in a second.
We'll get into that,
But I mean, people are very, the people who hold this universe dear, if you're going to say you're going to do Rogue Squadron, cool, have at it. I don't even really know much about Rogue Squadron. Doesn't, yeah, you can do whatever you want with that. But you're going to take, Han Solo, a person who's like grew up as people's hero on the wall kind of thing. I hope you don't mess it up. Like, the last thing I need to do is find out a backstory about him that like tarnishes the memory of who Han Solo is in the universe.
Because I assume you refer to yourself as a Star Warrior. That's what I'm now calling Star Wars fans.
Well, it's you and you alone.
Why? What do you call yourself?
I don't think they call them anything.
Well, I'm giving
they
you
don't
that
feel
name.
A need. Trekkies are Trekkies. Star Wars people are Star Wars people.
So how do you feel about it? Because, again, Star Wars resonates with you in a way. And again, yes, it's part of my childhood. But again, I think I've said on previous shows, I'm not so, I'll go and watch it. I enjoy it. The last three really put me off the whole thing altogether. But I know you're all the way in. You're far more of a fanatic than I am. When you heard that they might be origining Han Solo, what was your instant emotional reaction to that? Were you like, I'll leave it alone? Or were you like, okay.
I got the exact level of nervousness that I said. You know, it's fine, but it's not, I don't find it something that I needed. You know, it's not some story that I felt like, ooh, that's going to be a good story. It could be a good story, but it isn't like, it isn't like when you read a book and you're looking for more information that, you know, I would really like to hear how this person became.
But no one
because
needs
they are who
stuff.
They are, right?
You can make a case to me that, yes, we need the continuation.
Well,
of
oddly
the
enough, I mean, despite the fact that the next set of movies stunk, like the you know, the set of movies that gave us the origin story in Darth Vader, that was somewhat more interesting, I think, because Darth Vader was such a, there's this dude in a black plastic suit, you know, where did he come from? So getting a backstory on that, because we got some backstory,
the
dad of, like, so for whatever reason, Han Solo was already fully formed in a way Darth Vader was never fully formed, so you really never knew what it was. And so I don't have a need. At the same time, could be really cool. I mean, that, and what I think is, first of all, it's coming out in May of 2018, 3 years from now. I mean, we're not talking about like, oh, we're going to work on this, it'll be out in a year and a half. 3 years from now, like, talking about these directors who basically have only been directing movies for 3 years that we know of. You know, obviously, they'd done more before the big movies, but who the heck, 3 years from now, I mean, who knows? This, we already saw the Star Wars movies they're working on already have like writer and director changes and the like.
Oh, so this one doesn't even, this is just so an idea.
Who the heck knows? Yeah, like,
this,
I mean,
is just an idea.
It's amazing that they even announced it. You know, these guys are going to have to write the whole thing. They're busy working on, you know, Kasdan's busy working on the current one, right? Yeah. Or the current set of three, and now they're going to fit in this other piece, and who the heck knows? And the other part talking about is who's going to be the star, right? And so people are throwing names out there. Well, for one thing, it's 3 years from now, right? Like, and so, like, theoretically, this person's going to have to be younger.
Yeah.
Maybe not young, but, you know, 20s, 30s, something like that. But who the heck do we know? 3 years from now, who knows who's the right person? I imagine they don't cast this thing for a year and a half, right? I mean, there's no reason to cast it too much sooner. Although, I guess you start filming it maybe a little sooner than that. But they don't have to cast it now. People are throwing these names out there. And it's kind of funny. So we just talked about Jurassic Park. What does everybody say? Because what's hot right now? Chris Pratt. Get Chris Pratt to be the original Han Solo.
He'll be, I mean, he'll be,
he's already
too old.
Right. He's already kind of old. I mean, like, so I think, I forget how old Chris Pratt is, but another one that was mentioned, I forget the actor's name, but he's the one who played, was in Breaking Bad, was the younger understudy.
He's already bald.
Yeah, well, he's older than Harrison Ford was when they did the first one. Now he looks younger in some ways. Well, I guess that's not true if you look back at Han Solo at that point in time. Yeah, so he's not going to end up doing it. So you mentioned Comic-Con. Josh Holloway was there.
Okay.
I guess he just does Lost-related stuff and these things. And, you know, somebody, he didn't even know there was a Han Solo. And he's always professed his love for Han Solo. And the kind of character he played was sort of Han Solo-ish. And I think he made some Han Solo comments in Lost, like his character did. He's like, oh, I would love to. Now, he was not angling for the job, but he was like, oh, man, that'd be great to play him. Well, shoot, he's got to be 40 now. So I don't know how old he is, but there's no chance he's going to be the young Han Solo. But he would, if he had been, you know, a number of years ago, he would have been the kind of candidate you could think pulling off that kind of version of a person.
It is interesting.
Somebody was speculating, the guy from Firefly, Serenity, you know, that movie,
yeah.
movie in the TV
Josh
series.
Series.
Yeah, the main actor, they're like, oh, you know, he would
too
be,
old.
But he's already too old.
So
all these people throwing these old ideas around. Look at Ryan Reynolds.
I'm going for Ryan Reynolds. Ugh, I love Ryan Reynolds.
He's sunk, man. That selfless movie's a bomb. I think like the way they're casting the new movies, right? The new Star Wars, the main Star Wars movies. Those people are actors who like we are starting to know about. You know, they're well thought of, but they're really early in their career. I can't believe they aren't going to go with somebody just like that for Han Solo. Like one of the mentions was the guy from Whiplash, who's young enough, but I mean he's already on his trajectory up. They don't want to grab somebody like that.
See, it's funny. You mean so they
Miles
don't
Teller,
want they don't it. Want to grab someone like that? Is that your position?
I don't think so. I think they're going to want to grab somebody who's got like maybe at the point they cast him, he's done one movie that people are like that pretty good actor. We don't know about what he can do, but pretty good actor.
See, I'm not so sure about that. I think when you just used Miles Teller, and I was going to throw out, I'm not necessarily saying this guy, but a person who's at this stage of the career, you know, a Jamie Bell type who was, he was Billy Elliot on screen.
Oh.
And funny enough, those two are both in
because they started young, right?
No, well, but so those two were both in the Fantastic Four. They're both in the Fantastic Four movie coming out. What I'm saying is, I actually think it needs to be someone where he's not a star, but there is a subconscious level of familiarity. So, for example, if the Han Solo movie was coming out next week and, let's just pick him, Miles Teller was in it, you and I have seen Whiplash. Yeah, we know it, think it's a great film. But to the great general public who might not have seen what was basically a small independent movie.
Yeah, but Miles Teller's actually done
no, but what
five
I mean is,
or so
but that's what I'm saying. He's going to come on and you're not going to know Miles Teller, but you're going to go, oh, yeah, I that guy seems kind of familiar to me.
Yeah, but you
what I'm saying
you
is
couldn't
it's
cast
not,
him now because the Fantastic Four thing is,
no,
I mean, like,
no,
it's
no,
already.
No, but
like,
I don't mean get hung, but what I mean is, what it's not going to be is a complete unknown. Because then you really are gambling.
Not a complete unknown, but it's going to be pretty close, I think.
See, I'm not
look at
so
the people
sure.
who are casting it. Like, do you know the actors who are in the new Star Wars movie?
Oh, isn't the one girl?
Okafor and
I've seen the young guy. I saw him in this British movie, Attack the Block.
And
the girl, I don't. Daisy Ridley, I don't know. Isn't she on Game of Thrones?
No.
Is she Game of Thrones? I don't know. So I don't know
that. See, but she's been in something. But yeah, from your mind, she's sort of an unknown.
She's an unknown. And remember, they're not carrying this Star Wars movie. This Star Wars movie, yes, they may end up having to carry it, but they are helped along because you have ultimately Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, and Mark Hamill showing up. In the Han Solo prequel, it is going to be based completely around the magnetism of this star. Let me give you an example. The first time James Bond ever rebooted, and so what I meant was they cast a new guy.
Oh.
They went with the unknown Australian dude, and it was a disaster. And then the series only survived. They went back to Sean Connery, and then they got Roger Moore to play James Bond. Roger Moore was already familiar to a worldwide entertainment audience via TV shows and stuff like that.
Yeah, but I don't think you can.
No, and I'm not making a direct comparison.
No, it's not a direct comparison. I'm just the people Han Solo, who are running the business.
Han Solo, the character, in our minds, it's only ever been Harrison Ford.
Right. This is all the more reason why they're not going to use a big star. They'll use somebody unknown because they can just inhabit the Harrison Ford. You're not going to want anybody to come in there with a preconceived notion of who they are.
I don't know. I feel that because Sean Connery had been James Bond for 5 movies. Harrison Ford's been Han Solo for 6 movies, but 50 years. He's the only person in our minds who's been Han Solo. You're on a hiding to nothing if you're going to play young Han Solo. There's no way. There's no other I can't sit here and go, well, I know he's no Harrison Ford, but he's really playing Han Solo like he did in the books type thing. There's no bailout. The guys compared with Harrison Ford,
right?
Success or failure is based on that.
But that's why it's not going to be a big star. I don't think a big star would want to take that particular role. And even what I was going to say that's different about this Star Wars.
It's like they always talk about.
The Star Wars thing is like, listen, what you can say about now that it's owned by Disney is this is all calculated and this is scientific, this process now, the people who are running it. This is not like, what is it, who produced Broccoli and that whole crew that was doing this, where it was like, sure, we'll grab this guy. This is field tested, audience tested, surveys supported, all this sort of stuff that's going to go into this process for this sort of thing. At the same time, what I do see in the fact of people being like, oh, okay, that's interesting kind of thing, is the beginning of the turn that could happen to this Star Wars thing. Like, it's one thing to take over our beloved franchise and be like, okay, listen, these movies are going to be better than the last 3 movies that Lucas just sort of ran, and it was just sort of a mess with its animations and all that cheesy Jar Jar Binks type of stuff. It's another thing to say, listen, we're going to crank out these suckers like crazy, because the more you fill chaff around the sides, the less people are going to feel like their little core. What they might do is just sort of abandon the franchise. Like, you know, the people who are our age, who originally grew up with a Star Wars, they're not going to go see 3 Star Wars movies. This is not like the Marvel universe where a bunch of people go see about 3 Marvel movies in a year. I'm not going to see 3 Star Wars movies in a year. It's just not happening. And I'm one of the biggest fans because it's just too much stuff. Like, I mean, none of it all can be all that important, but maybe they don't care because they're going to still sell their amount of tickets. I mean, I think you can see that with the Marvel thing. A bunch of people are starting on the Marvel thing to go, okay, now what, folks? You know, you did all the character establishment. Are we going to care when now, like, you know, for people who don't know, the next wave of the Marvel stuff is like a civil war amongst these people. And a bunch of people said, like, ooh, that's great for the comic book reader who's, like, really into the comic books and into all the minutiae, but that's not necessarily what the world is going to want to watch. And I don't know, you know, how many Han Solo backstory maybe works. Rogue Squadron, who knows how many people are going to care about it. You know, what's the next 3 ones going to be after that? Backstory on
anyone.
Yeah.
Random character. Well, yeah. I mean, I guess the only one, ultimately, though, Han Solo is the only one who is sort of, Han Solo's character belongs to the first 3 movies, whereas,
well, that's right. We already know Luke and Leia because we saw them get dropped off as little babies in their spots. We already, certainly for Luke, we kind of know what he did. He landed there. He had his moisture farm, and then he left.
Yeah, I mean,
he didn't really have a lot of adventures.
In a weird way, you know, people talk about, I mean, you mentioned a Boba Fett prequel.
Yeah, I had never heard about that until it was on the list. But
I don't, yeah.
Well, the Boba Fett story is, I don't get into it, it's sort of, because he's sort of part of this the base of the, he's the kid of Jango Fett, who was like the base of the clones that made the starch, it's all this stuff.
You're losing me here.
That's fine.
So anyway, they were all at Comic-Con. They have announced a Star Wars prequel. You believe someone pretty much an unknown. I believe someone who is subconsciously in our...
All I can say is we're actually agreeing on that point.
Yes.
I don't know there's any difference there. So
that's the big Star Wars news.
Yeah. Yep.
Staying in entertainment.
In other entertainment, this past weekend... Well, wait. What are we on? Yes, last weekend, the 4th of July weekend, was the final three concerts of The Dead, Grateful Dead, basically.
I did see that.
Yeah, so...
And I sort of raised an eyebrow, because, I mean, I'm not... Before you really get going, I'm not a... What's the word for a Grateful Dead fan? A deadhead. I'm not a deadhead
that has
by
a name.
Any stretch.
Right. Well, you know what's interesting, I think, about the Grateful Dead is most sort of rock-related musics have done this cross... I mean, perfect for our podcast. Between Britain and America, they kind of exchange things back and forth.
Yeah.
You got the blues goes over there, begets Rolling Stones and Beatles, which comes back and begets like rock and roll bands, yes, and the pop rock type, you know, like the rock and roll that we became accustomed to in the 70s and 80s and things like that. And it goes back and forth. Metal, different variations on each side of the pond.
Punk rock.
Punk rock, right?
And for whatever reason, completely fair, rap music has spawned a lot of European rap that's actually quite good.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, yeah.
But the jam bands, which is like the Grateful Dead and Phish and, I mean, Allman Brothers for that matter, and other bands that have these sort of long improvisational songs with, you know, basically high instrumental skills, but, you know, they'll improvise a bunch of things. And,
very much an American thing.
Not really versatile. I guess in some respects, is Afghan Wigs. There may be some little touches of it but what you do have in exchange, actually, as I think about it, there is Psychedelia, which you have Pink Floyd, which I forget what year Pink Floyd started.
But they're contemporaries. Pink Floyd were not spawned by the Grateful Dead.
Right. There's all the some of the first stuff that the Grateful Dead came out with was almost, so they formed in 65, really broke out in like 67 is when, you know, albums come out, or maybe that was, you know, when their first sort of things start get going, Summer Love and San Francisco and that sort of stuff. But 65 is their real formation, which is why this year is now their 50th year. So they go on, and anyway, so it's been exchanged around, you know, the Grateful Dead, basically you could look at it 65 to 95 for 30 years.
Yep.
Jerry Garcia, the main guitarist, dies. They then never...
See, to me, that was it. Then.
Well, and it was officially... There was never the Grateful Dead ever after that.
Yeah.
Like, in all their other iterations, they were the Other Ones or Dead or something like that. And as they approached the 50th anniversary, they said, okay, we're going to do what they call them the Fare Thee Well concerts. Well, I mean, that's a lot of people said that.
That's what it felt like to me. And I'm not a fan. I don't follow them. So it's easier for me to be cynical. I did feel that when Jerry Garcia died... I mean, he lives on in ice cream, and that's about it.
Well,
but seriously, I felt at that moment, in terms of what you've just said,
right?
For the Grateful Dead.
You know, I've seen a little bit of it since then, but like I started listening to him in high school in like the mid to late '80s, just before that sort of stuff happened. But in any event, they do this, and that's been part of the argument, is it's a money grab. At the same time, they've done all this bouncing around. I think it was almost for their own sake that they said, "This is it. We're going to do these concerts. We're not going to put all of us." I mean, a couple of them are in their 70s now.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to put this together. Trey Anastasio's from Phish played in the Jerry Garcia role. Bruce Hornsby, who actually played with iterations of the Dead
they have their own ice cream as well.
I think Bruce Hornsby already had played some concerts with them starting like 92, so before Jerry Garcia died.
He played
in another guy, Comenti, played keyboards for some of the stuff. But that was the lineup, and so
they originally have an ice cream.
No, they originally announced these three concerts in Chicago, Soldier Field, you know, where the Bears play, and they sold out in
75,000 seats.
Like, and they had the old school version of like where you mail in envelopes to get tickets in a raffle system, basically.
So this isn't again,
and because it was such a high demand, they added two more shows in California before these, which in practice apparently functioned more like warm-up shows, like they were just basically almost practicing on stage kind of thing. But
still, there were people piling out.
So this became a huge event, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they wanted to make money. And one of the elements of making money is that these bands have been around that long and have toured for that long. They have a whole ecosystem of employees around them. Yeah. And so sometimes when they do especially this stuff, like a number of bands had said when they get to that point, they're like, we kind of had to tour because we got like 500 people who work for us, yes, and they have nothing to do if we don't tour. And so we're trying to keep them gainfully employed. And, you know, the tickets were very expensive and, you know, there's all kinds of things there. But anyway, they do the concerts. The ones in California were so-so reviewed. The ones in Chicago were generally more positively reviewed. I mean, one of the interesting things is, and I'm a big fan of Fish, but the Tranastasia got great review, like just really did some, stepped up, did some interesting things within the confines of their stuff. He wasn't just imitating Jerry it wasn't like a tribute thing, he was doing his own thing, mixing it all up and added some energy to these 70-year-olds because he's only in his 40s, right? So it's kind of funny that that's the youthful person in the band. But they also did webcasts of all these.
Yeah.
So you could,
and I think they did one of those where you could go to your local movie theater.
Yeah, yeah, yes, yeah. And, so the webcasts were ridiculously overpriced. I forget. I don't remember the.
But people, if you pay. Want,
well, so what really happened is a lot of it got just basically bootlegged out. Like, yeah. So a bunch of people I know who listened to it. So you could listen to it. You could go to like Ustream or something like that, and people were taking their paid for webcasts. And initially, I understand, like, I didn't see this, but the first couple of days they were actually just putting out the video stream, but they would get like shut down. Like, so people who are like looking at it on like a bootleg video stream, yeah, instead of paying the amount of money would be like, oh, I watch this for 20 minutes, it gets shut down. You go back on Twitter, you find out who's put it up, you watch it again, you watch again. And ultimately, I think all that went away, and basically the band must have decided, we don't care if you stream the audio out.
But the Dead have always been that way, though. The Dead and Fish and some of those bands have always had that different relationship with their fans.
This is a big difference between the video and audio. I think they ultimately decided, listen, we'll go ahead and let people put the, because I listened to the audio. Not no video, but just audio for two of the concerts. Not the whole things, but I was dipping in and out. And they're not. I think they basically said, listen, all this is going to come out. Because then they have audience taping. They allow you to bring your microphones in and tape in a certain section. Well, those things are all available, like fully legally. You can go to archive.org, which is like that website that keeps – it's like supposed to, trying to archive the whole internet, but they have a section of it they have a section of it called the Wayback Machine, which is interesting. It shows you web pages the way they looked over history. So like you can look at the Amazon website the first week it opened.
Oh, really?
And it's like this, like, you know, clunky looking AOL type of thing. But one of the other things they have is a huge music archive, live music archive, and any bands that allow sort of trading of the recordings and things like that.
And the Dead have always been
So you can go on there. So you can go to archive and you can listen to these three. You can listen to all five concerts and just stream them on your computer or download the whole things in high resolution audio. In any event, it was pretty good. It's definitely got some misses in it, which is kind of what the Grateful Dead was anyway.
70-year-old men.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, I'm not putting the boot.
Yeah, that's what happens. Like, just with, I think that's when they had to add these people in because it was very plodding. Well, just the 70-year-olds doing this stuff, and then like you add somebody, oh, he's in his 40s, and it like really rips it up, and everybody kind of steps up the pace to kind of keep up with them. But it was, you know, generally pretty good. I haven't listened to it all the way through, but
so they're done.
Here's the thing, right? Like, they're done, but they could ease, like, so Bob Weir's the other guitarist, and he does his own band thing with Rat Dog, which sometimes will have people from, I think, the drummer from there, Phil Lesh, who's the bass player. He'll do a thing. He's got his own thing. He has a standing gig up somewhere in upstate New York.
And so they're done as the great
thing. I think that's the idea. I'm not even really clear they all get along that well. Like, when Trey Anastasia was
about 70,
he had to learn 90 songs for these 5 days.
Oh, God.
And
it killed him.
He basically, he went to one person's place, played a bunch of songs with them, and went to the other person's place. Like, he wasn't necessarily playing all of them at one time. It's like, because, oh, I'll go to your place and learn these songs. So kind of interesting phenomenon. But yeah, in theory, this should be all really, they're certainly not going to be doing Soldier Field on a regular basis anymore. It's the smaller iterations play in smaller houses, you know, like,
because apparently the Rolling Stones are touring again this summer, but they're only doing like 6 or 7 dates and all in relatively offbeat cities.
Yeah.
Like Charlotte, Buffalo.
U2's not doing all offbeat cities, but it's like U2 is coming for a tour in America, but they're not stopping in Washington, D.C. They're doing like 3 nights in Boston, 3 nights in Madison Square Garden, but like never setting foot into Washington, D.C. or some other areas. But I think what's really interesting is, like, so, like I said, 65 to 95, 30 years, they're – with Jerry Garcia. And then it's been another 20 since then with all these iterations going around. When I listened to them in the 80s, right, the middle 80s, so they're 20, 25 years in.
Yeah.
I thought they were like ancient history. Like, oh, that's the way back, the hippie era, you know?
Well, it is though, isn't it?
But
you're right.
But that's like a blink of the eye now, right? Like, so 20 years ago now is 1995. What bands came out in 1995? Would you go, that's ancient history? 1995 is like yesterday.
Yes, that's true.
Like, way back in the grunge era when people used to wear flannel shirts. Ooh, that was crazy stuff then.
Yeah.
U2's now been, U2 started playing in the late 70s. Early 80s,
79, 80s,
before they busted out. But that's,
you've just blown my mind when you've said that.
Exactly.
I've just
45,
done the math and gone realize 35 years.
No, 80, 20, 30, oh, 35.
35 years, so but still.
Yeah. Well, that's they're 15 years younger than the Grateful Dead. U2 to Grateful Dead is a 15-year span. That's nothing. And
they're a couple of years older than Harrison Ford.
Exactly, right. So it's real interesting. I don't know where that takes us, but, you know, if anybody's sort of interested and hasn't been keeping up and maybe they were Grateful Dead fans in the past, I just recommend you go to Archive. They're going to release all the Chicago concerts on Blu-ray and DVD, and so you get the pristine soundboard audio. But that's like the pre-sale for that is like, I think the set is like $180 or something like that.
I was driving someone else's vehicle last week on a road trip, and they have satellite radio, Sirius. I don't have that because I'm a minch bag. Mm-hmm. I just listen to my phone. I just listen to music on my iPod, and I listen to free radio. The Grateful Dead have their own channel on Sirius.
Oh yeah.
Which didn't amaze me. It didn't surprise me.
But so does
me.
Pearl Jam, I think.
No, well, they do, but they share it with... The Grateful Dead channel is nothing but Grateful Dead tracks. Right. Pearl Jam are on a channel, I think it's called Lithium, where it is...
There was a Pearl Jam. It might be go away. A lot of the stations will come and go, and so yeah, for a while there, Grateful for at least Dead, a year, there was a Pearl Jam concert.
Because I'm not even sure
There's a Bruce Springsteen channel, I think.
There is, but I don't even think the Beatles have their own channel.
Well, the one thing about the Grateful Dead, because of all the live recordings, there's endless permutations of, like, it'd be the same song. Where the Beatles, you're going to go through the whole catalog.
So it's interesting. With that being said, even though we do, yes, this is it for the Grateful Dead, they've already begun the stage where you're weaning in other guys. So as long as there's one Grateful Dead person alive, I'm sure you can hash out some sort of Grateful Dead affiliated event that has
maybe an occasional tribute show, Trey Anastasia is not going to go touring the country Dead songs.
It's not a tribute show. It could still be seen as original product because at least one of the dudes is still alive.
Well, they don't write anything original anymore. So
all right, so that's that. Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
All right, so let's here's my segue to our last topic. We're going to go from Grateful Dead to Birth. Hey, you like that?
I was going to say, now for something completely different.
Okay.
There was an article, well, you don't know, but in terms of the listener, but you know, Zeph.
I do know,
there was an article in the Washington Post talking about scientists have discovered how the month you're born in matters for your health.
I immediately panicked when you sent this to me, and I started reading the article to see if they were listing things by month so I could see what kind of a death risk I was at.
Uh-huh.
And again, I scanned through the article, and then I immediately found, overall, the researchers found that being born in June, August, January, and December provided no big advantage or disadvantage when it came to disease. Because I'm born in August, I immediately took a sigh of relief and then just scanned over the rest of the article. Because I knew that I was safe by the numbers and didn't have to worry.
So it's funny, this article and some of the others, there was an article, I think, in The Guardian talking about the same study, which the study was Columbia University Department of Medicine, Mary Regina Bolin, Nicholas Tatonetti, and other researchers. But they were comparing it to astrology, right? Like, people's personalities are different than the like. But I think that was really mostly the newspaper trying to put some sort of spin on
humorous
the whole
spin
bit.
On, which I thought was quite insulting to the science.
Yeah, exactly.
Because obviously astrology
Funny. So what they did, 1.75 million patients born between 1900 and 2000 who had been treated at Columbia University Medical Center, where they said, okay, let's look at the diseases they had. We have all the diseases. places, and we have the birth dates. And let's see what kind of patterns emerge here in terms of correlation. The one thing that's really annoying about the article, it doesn't show the degree of enhanced risk on anything. So
yes,
it's got all these boxes that show, oh, that's higher and that's lower, but none of it is like, you can't
part of the article.
Yeah, it didn't print properly. This is why I had to do this stuff. You'll be able to look here in a second.
But okay,
there's nothing that says, is that a 5% greater incidence, in which case who cares, right?
Yeah.
Or is it a 50% greater incidence, in which case, wow, that kind of matters, you know? But it's all the risks of illness resulting from these different months. You know, they caution the fact that this is all New York based. Well, I should say, so there's a bunch of theories. Why would this be? Actually, let's talk about what the things are. Like, so you mentioned June and August are generally neutral. So they tracked not only enhance risk, but reduce risk. Like, and so there's, in addition to like the upside on these graphs where things are higher risk, the downsides mean you had a reduced risk of this issue. So like overall, the reduced risk months of illness are February, March, and April. June, August, and that range are kind of neutral.
Okay, that's good enough
then
for me.
Then October, November, things go up. You get a higher risk overall. Risk. But then when you break it down even more into like particular types of diseases, there's total mismatch of things. So respiratory diseases, highest risk is if you're born in October, November. Cardiovascular, heart-related diseases, highest risk if you're born in March and April. And in fact, the folks who are March and April apparently have the shortest lifespan because cardiovascular risk tends to lead to you dying, whereas respiratory is asthma and stuff like that. Neurological, apparently ADHD, higher risk if you're born in November.
Okay.
I assume that this doesn't all go back to 1900 because I don't think they were diagnosing ADHD on people who were born in 1900. But this and this isn't like they aren't totally inventing things here. There, when you look through it, there are studies going back to the 1980s, like the respiratory one in particular. And I think that's the easiest one to talk about theories. That one, it's been tracked back to early 80s, where people said definitely kids who were born in the latter part of just before winter have a higher respiratory risk. And the question is, well, why? And there's a bunch of theories. Like, if you're born in the winter, you probably spend a bunch more of your time indoors right out of the gate in sealed buildings, and there's more dust mites. And so that may be encouraging you to get more asthma issues. You're not outdoors where you maybe get some exposure to things. The other one on the heart risk is apparently vitamin D related, which I don't know if being out in the sun gives you too much. Maybe you get too much vitamin D and that leads to issues. I'm not quite sure. Not a lot of details because they're not trying to. These are all speculation as to causation. Sure. They're just marking correlation at this point.
I found it interesting. I find it interesting right now, right at this moment, with you giving me your perception of the data, that you immediately went to when they were born. When I read the article, the first thing that my mind jumped to wasn't when you were born, but when you were conceived and when you're in the womb. Because one thing I think that is true, full stop, is all of us ultimately, and I know this me personally, it's genetic. So sure. It's from your parents. So I immediately took the jump like
genetic.
You know, these scientists, they're saying when it's born because us Joe readers can understand that. But my mind immediately started working everything on 9 months back to see where you were in the born, where you were in the womb. I mean, it's like that old thing about if while you were in the womb, you know, I think there's a study that if your mother was constantly eating ice cream and sweet food, then at some level, that's your tendency. So what I'm saying is, when I, you know, you looked at the respiratory stuff, what's the respiratory months?
The bad ones, October, November.
All right, so if you go back 9 months, you're in the womb during April and May, when I know in Northern Hemisphere countries,
spring, which this is all this is. I mean, this spring, obviously is it's New
asthma,
York based.
So. Ragweed, pollen. That's when your parent, your mother, is carrying you, and she's breathing and all that stuff.
Yeah, but realize that shouldn't lead to an asthma issue. I mean, like, I agree.
But you know what I mean?
It's entirely possible.
Parents are. What I'm saying is, it's...
No, but you're not intaking the whole issue of. It's not just things being in your blood, it's things being in your lungs. And when you're in a womb, nothing's going into your lungs. You're not even...
No, but the conditions, you are then predisposed.
Why would you be predisposed to asthma based on things that happen in the womb? You weren't even using those parts of your body.
Because it's genetic.
I'm not saying that that is wrong. I'm just saying on certain things, I'm sure it's outside.
I just found it interesting that you immediately went to thinking of the first 3 to 4 months of
I mean, I will say alive. That's what the headline said. You went
that's what I'm saying. I immediately thought, well, the headline is wrong. It's all about when you're conceived. I think
your inherent skepticism.
I went inside the headline.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, listen, you know,
all I know is
what's the result of this, right? Like, so
I'm fine.
Some people might read this and you go, listen, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about genetic engineering for kids, you know, like, okay, is that where we're going to go, where you could say, okay, well, I can tweak something here and end up with, well, here's a simple version. You could just arrange for your kid to be born a different time of the year, like arrange for your kid to be born in June, meaning, you know, when you're going to have your conception, line it up properly instead of end of the year.
June and August, January and December. If you're out there, I would shoot for January and December because those months are aligned. So yeah, you have an 8-week window to hit.
Yeah, but then your kid has has to share a gift with the double holiday thing.
Well, but you know something? At least your kid's got that.
Sacrifices have to be made. They've got
their health. I mean, really.
Well, those are ones that are neutral. Like, so they're saying, you know, and then they're saying, obviously, lots more things have to do with this. But it's kind of interesting. The other thing, like in March. So I get the high heart risk.
Oh, so you're high risk.
Yeah. Well, high heart risk, but very, like, I have greater protection than June does for a bunch of seats. So like if you look at the overall chart.
So when are you
This conceived? Is the overall chart, the lower things.
I'm just trying to figure out when you were conceived. Probably June.
Whatever, June, whatever, July. 9 months, yeah.
Yeah, June or July, okay.
So like when you look at, see the negative parts of the bars in the early part of the year, that's resistance to a bunch of other illnesses. So you've got like heightened risk of certain things, but resistance to others, whereas like the June, that's just like a smaller band. It's just more neutral.
What's August? August is entirely neutral.
Yeah, August both is about flat, basically. Oh,
perfect, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'm up for that. Yeah. Beyond Steven. That, you're on your own. Yeah.
But the other thing that I was thinking is what it could be result in is the other talk is about customized treatment of people. Where, like, you know, when we're treating a cancer, let's go look at the genetics of the particular case and can we target our treatment? Well, this would be a simpler version, right? If you're born in October and November, maybe we just become more heightened to the, you know, aware as a doctor to the possibility of respiratory illnesses. And so you go after that stuff first.
See, obviously we'll link this article on the blog if you want to watch it. But I'm now, if you want to read it, I'm now going to challenge these scientists. I'm going to throw them a challenge. Mm-hmm. Because again, because I do tend to believe that ultimately the genes are the overriding factor, to me, and I've got an idea out there.
But here's the thing.
Hold on, no, I've got an idea.
No, this doesn't really make any sense, actually.
No. But listen, I've got a serious point I'm about to make.
I'm going
to
shut it down in a second.
I think that someone needs to do a study where you are combining your own birth with your mother's birth. And then it's a combination of, so for example, my mom's birthday is in April. My birthday is in August. So there now needs to be a secondary chart to see, do you know what I mean? And I think you might be onto something there.
No,
because it's your mother and then you.
I don't really know what you're talking about, but here's the thing.
What do you mean you don't know what I'm talking about? What I'm talking here's about thing, is I'm trying to like combine.
I'm realizing that what you described about the fetus and the you know, their mom's breathing the allergens,
yeah,
that has nothing to do with genetics, you know.
Well, what I mean is it's all to do with, I don't mean genetics. What I mean is it's not just when you were born and out in the world. It's what whoever is carrying you. What they are exposed
sure,
to.
Sure. That's just environmental.
What I'm saying
that's
is...
That's still environmental. See, so your theory that the genetics are the important part has nothing to do with this. Genetics, this, the time of month that you're conceived or born doesn't change your genetics. Your genetics are what they are based on the combination, unless you're suggesting that the DNA molecules will merge differently depending upon what the phase of the moon is or something.
Maybe.
Yeah, well.
But all I'm saying is, I actually think there is something to this study.
Well, I'm trying to say is, something to study.
In order to make the study more accurate, it needs to be combined.
I don't know why that would matter.
Because of you don't have a scientific mind. you just can't follow along. Listeners, they know what I'm talking about here. Uh-huh. It's the two things combined.
That makes two of you.
All right. Anything else on the month you were born? All I know is I'm safe, so It doesn't say anything. One of the articles
out of England was they must have combined this with like studies about what jobs you'd have. And so it lists like a celebrity and what they do, what month it is. And then it lists like, oh, you're more likely to be a garbage man if you were born in this month, or you're more likely. And then the illness as well. So they're combining it with some more. Although that's probably, you know, the statistics on those things. Yeah, it's not like they're making it up. Yeah. You know, how many more people are born these times? But
I don't know. See, that, is that.
But it was more humorous.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. I mean, you know. Then you're heading into astrology territory here. But I do think there is something to this.
There's obviously something to it. I mean, whether it's...
I do think there's something to it, although I do think the scientists should follow my advice and really get deeper inside to really come up with some...
We'll let them know.
Yeah. I think, is that it for this? Is that it for this episode? Just done the month you were born. We have our next month of the show planned out.
Right. Best of show coming out.
On the next one, so my partner and I will be forewarned that
Zeph recorded all the interspersed parts, so at which point he'll undoubtedly be giving me a hard time for not being there.
And then beyond that, we have our new special of the new season. I guess it's always our new season when we start over in August.
That's playing coffee. That was our half-baked one we were talking about last episode.
We're still figuring out how to do it.
Subject to potential change, nothing definite. But
we might be out and around drinking coffee and hopefully providing you all with some useful information.
Try a range of coffees.
All right. That's your lot. This has been the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at Libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at AtlanticVoice.net. Email us at AtlanticVoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for the Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.